Thank you for listening to We Have Ways of Making You Talk. Sign up to our Patreon to receive bonus content, live streams, and our weekly newsletter with money off books and museum visits as well, plus early access to all live show tickets. That's patreon.com/wehaveways.
This episode is brought to you by UiPath. Human achievement can be slow. 200,000 years to go from the wheel to your jalopy? Really? But today, 90% of the Fortune 500 are accelerating human achievement simply. When AI is everywhere, every process can be automated and accelerated. 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 UiPath, the AI everywhere foundation of innovation.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Buzz around artificial intelligence is seemingly everywhere. Is your portfolio keeping up? Consider the GlobalX Artificial Intelligence and Technology ETF, ticker AIQ, which invests in dozens of stocks at the leading edge of this disruption. Investing involves risk, including possible loss of principal. Technology companies can be affected by rapid product obsolescence and intense industry competition. Before investing, carefully consider the fund's objectives, risks, charges, expenses, and more in the full or summary prospectus at globalxetfs.com. Read carefully. Distributed by SEI Investments Distribution Co.
Achtung, achtung. Welcome to We Have Ways of Making You Talk with me, Al Murray, and James Holland, the Second World War podcast. All your Second World War podcast needs. And James, we're joined by a very special guest today. There's a sort of extraordinary kind of personal connection with this guest. Something we've been talking about for a while since you discovered the letters and all this sort of stuff. So, Jim, who are we talking to and who are we going to talk about?
Well, we've got a bit of a TV legend here. We've got Charlie Lawson, none other than Jim McDonald from Coronation Street. a party played in a staggering 1,168 episodes between 1989 and 2018. And he's been in many other things besides. The most extraordinary thing, because when I was writing Savage Storm, my first sort of chunk of the Italian campaign, I came across these letters by an Australian guy called Laurie Franklin Vale. And incredibly moving and vivid they were too. When he got out to, first to Sicily and then into mainland Italy, Laurie Franklin Vale became very, very good friends of a guy in his company who he called John Glennie, also known as Gordon Glennie. It turns out that fellow, who very, very sadly died just north of Termoli, in the latter half of 1943, in Laurie Franklin Vale's arms in a night attack, he'd got machine gunned across the chest and bled out, is the uncle of Charlie Lawson. Whoever would have thought it? And then a few weeks ago, or a month ago, or whatever it was, a massive package arrived in the post, and it's all Gordon's letters and amazing. Various other things, his wrist identity bracelet and other things, and a little Bible and prayer book and various other things. And I want you to know, Charlie, they are now safe in a fireproof case. all labelled and organised, and I'm absolutely terrified. I need to get them back to you as soon as possible.
Well, imagine my delight and emotions when listening to your podcast and the name, you can't really miss it, Laurie Franklin Vale came up. I immediately yelled to Debbie in the kitchen, "Debbie, in the name of God, it's Gordy!" And I listened, and it was extraordinary. And I raced upstairs, got the letters, and the rest is, well, it's not history. Well, it is history, you know what I mean? But of course, I was familiar with Gordon, or Gordy, or indeed Paddy, as one of his girlfriends used to call him when he was in training, or John. When Gordy met Laurie or Frank, as my mum knew him as, we'll come to, they became huge friends, and it was so emotional. And people think I'm a sort of a stoical hard man and blah 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 all the rest of it, but to read about Gordy's death in Frank's arms on that night raid, and indeed to open the letters that my mother had exchanged with Laurie Franklin Vail, because there had been, I think you mentioned this, James, that there was a sort of an agreement between Gordy and Frank that they would write to respective wives as well and keep in touch with them. And of course I delved into this bloody box, and there was Muriel, my mother, writing to Laurie Franklin Vail, and vice versa, and the letter he wrote to Muriel about Gordy's death was just, I was in bits, and Debbie was in and out the room saying, what in the name of God's going on? And then of course I discovered the letters that Muriel had written to Gordon, and they had been sent back because he had been killed in action, and she hadn't opened those letters, she just put them in a box and left them. So very carefully I got a chance to open the letters that had been caught in transit, if you like, between her writing to Gordon and his death, and unsealed them and read them. And it was an extraordinary, it's almost like living history, you know what I mean? Quite extraordinary to have all these things from that campaign. So I enjoy your podcast anyway, but of course the Italian stuff, and I can't wait to get the book, by the way. Is extraordinary, and we now have a picture of Laurie up on the wall, and of course Gordy's up there on the wall as well. It is extraordinary, and they were so close. Indeed, I was saying to, you probably know Eddie O'Sullivan or whatever, well, I was saying to him, and I may have spoken to you about it on the phone, the bond they had in the friendship was extraordinary, and if you took the letters out of context now, you'd maybe be forgiven for thinking that they were actually lovers, and I mean that in a perfectly serious way. They weren't, but they were extraordinarily close friends, and you can imagine that men at war staring death in the face every day, I should imagine friendships are extraordinary.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely true. I wondered that a bit myself, I'm not going to lie. But actually, I've been reading quite a few other accounts. There's an aspiring poet called John Strick, who is in, funny enough, he's in the London Irish rather than the Fogs, but another Irish battalion. His Batman is a chap called Jack Hargreaves. It's clear there is another kind of sort of very intense personal but entirely platonic relationship between those two as well, very much on the same kind of same level as Laurie Franklin Vail and your uncle. And I think you're absolutely right. I think it's when you're just staring death in the face every minute. You have these relationships, these friendships. They become like sort of soulmates to one another. And I remember when I was doing the Sherwood Rangers book, Stephen Mitchell and Stanley Christopherson, they were like soulmates. And I remember John Semkin, one of the guys who was in the regiment, saying to me, "You needed a soulmate. You needed someone." And he said, Stanley Christopherson and Stephen Mitchell were like that. They absolutely kind of fed off one another, and they kept each other going. And you see that with Laurie and Gordon, I think.
Well, but then the danger is when you lose your soulmate, what it does to you, which is the corollary of that, is you do, the whole thing is intense, isn't it? Every hot meal you eat could be your last hot meal, or the only hot meal you eat that week, and you know, every cigarette could be your last cigarette. Absolutely every detail of your existence. And you're living, you know, you're living outdoors. Everything's pressured. Everything's intense. And so those kind of human relationships, I think.
And I think that comes across when Gordy was shot badly and Laurie came to his aid. And, you know, the description of Gordy's death and when he looked up and Laurie was in tears in his arms, and Gordy said, "Stop it." You know what I mean? It's you can. It's such a great letter to my mother describing his death, because of course normally you would just get a wee telegram that would say killed in action or whatever. But when you read the description of the field at night, and the action, and then his final, you know, his final breath. It's quite extraordinary document, and we're very lucky to have letters like this. And I'm sure there's lots of people out there who listen to your podcast who probably have similar. They are to be treasured and I think shared.
Well, I was absolutely thrilled to get the package, albeit a little bit nervous to be custodian of them, albeit temporarily, and. You know, they are absolutely extraordinary. The great thing is actually their handwriting is quite readable. So yeah, yes. that really helps. I mean, I've got a. I remember when I was first in this caper, and you know, the way to get in contact to veterans was to write them a letter. So I'd sort of type off a letter. And I remember Rachel would say, "Oh, there's another scratchy handwriting for you." You know, it's another envelope came through the door. And, you know, some of them are really, really difficult to read, but you get a kind of sort of quite a practiced eye at this kind of stuff. But those ones, Laurie Franklin Vale and Gordy's handwriting, incredibly legible. I mean, Charlie, tell us a little bit about the family and the background and Gordy and your mum and you know, what they were about. They're obviously Enniskillen people, aren't they?
Yeah, and as you may or may not know, education in Ireland, north and south, is although to its detriment, I suppose, completely religious based, Protestant and Catholic. There's huge numbers of boarding schools and public schools. That's just the way the system is, rather like Scotland. Now, they're not Eton or Harrow or Winchester, believe you me. They're tough places. And anyway, Portora Royal was the school, the boys and young men's boarding school in Enniskillen, and Gordy went there and tried to join up so he had a good education, but he became a sort of fundamentally very devout Christian even as a young man. He tried to join up and he was found out. He was too young. Then he met the following year he joined up and eventually ended up with the Fox, as you know, as the Royal Irish Fusiliers. He kept his Christianity with him, you know, always, and he was fairly devout. I mean, as you've seen, he carried his pocket Bible, and I've you know, which he died with, and I've always wondered what that mark is, that burn mark on the cover, and you have to speculate. That's obviously something to do with his final end. But Muriel, his sister, my mother, she joined up and served at Castle Archdale, which was a Catalina and Sunderland flying boat base on Lough Erne. It was also where there was a huge contingent of Americans and South Africans and Canadians who were there on the way to the Normandy landings. They all sort of arrived and stayed there, and Muriel always spoke very fondly about the South Africans and the Canadians. She'd been used to sort of farming men from Enniskillen. And I think when the South Africans and Canadians arrived in uniform, she was quite taken by them. Castle Archdale, incidentally, is still there, and if you steamed out from the harbour out into the broad lake where the Sunderlands and Catalinas were moored, there are several of them that were sunk at the end of the war, and indeed all the equipment and all the vehicles, etc., were taken out in barges and just sunk in the middle of the broad lake in Lough Erne. There has been several attempts to bring them up, but of course it's a... You need a good deal of money to do all that sort of carry on. So they're still there. Anyway, so off Gordy went, and as I say, the rest is in the letters. Meanwhile, there, yes, I mean, look at that, folks.
So I'm just holding up the little Bible, and it's got the burn mark.
Yeah,
on it.
And you sort of have to wonder what that was all about. But meanwhile, my father had just the story about Quinton. He was up in Belfast with his brother George at Campbell College, which I think has probably still had the most people killed from one of the schools in Northern Ireland. And that's where I went to school, and the war memorial's inside the building. And everything to do with Campbell College is really based around the sacrifice that these young men made. Anyway, Q was there studying biology, and he went down to do his interview at down in Dublin at the famous university there. And on the way back up, he threw his papers out the window, got off the train, and joined the RAF. And in 1944, he ended up having trained all around Stratford-upon-Avon at Long Marston Aerodrome and all around there. He went to South Africa to finish his training. And from South Africa, he went to Burma. And you would know, boys, more about this than me, but he was in 79 Squadron, which was a sponsored squadron by the presidency of Madras. Now, the only thing I could gather about that was that it was really a hugely Commonwealth bunch of people who flew together, Sikhs, Canadians, Americans, all sorts of, but it was sponsored by the presidency of Madras, and it's all in his logbook. And I can find nothing about this, but he was up the Irrawaddy River with 79 Squadron flying Hurricanes and Thunderbolts. And I think they took what they could get up there. And his two cook campaigns were Imphal and...
God. Small ones, then.
Yeah. But
Imphal's one of the biggest battles that the 14th Army fought in the entire war.
But he flew 116 missions. I don't know whether that's a lot in the scheme of things. I always remember from the movies, the Battle of Britain, he did 60 or something and he went home to back to America or whatever, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, his stories are legend. And when he was flying Thunderbolts, a couple of things that... I've seen the photographs, and there's a red setter on the airfield in his cockpit and all that sort of stuff, an Irish setter.
Amazing.
They used to do something called the Grog Run, which was you flew down to Rangoon and with enough fuel to get you there. And then on the way back, one of the wing tanks was stuffed full of fags and booze, and that was called the Grog Run. And I said, are you serious, Dad? He said, oh, yeah, yeah. He said, they took it in turns, you know, to fly down there and come back on the Grog Run. His most serious injury was he was pished and fell into a man trap around the edge of the airfield, and he got a spike through his elbow, and he had to have, he said the worst part of the war was having 8 rabies injections a day. But he had a good war. He enjoyed it, and wasn't ashamed to say that. Although it was a very tough time, he enjoyed the war, and I think was at a complete loss when he came back. Meanwhile, his brother George was on the Atlantic convoys out of Derry / Londonderry, they both came back. And Northern Ireland has always been a hotbed of you know what, and they were living in Strabane of all places, which is a fairly Republican town. But they lived there anyway and refused to take their uniforms off, and of course delighted in winding up the locals on a Saturday night, ending up in jail for fighting. So
Oh my God! So you do the Atlantic convoy, come back, get in a scrap, spend the night in jail, and then go back to Halifax or something.
And meanwhile, Gordy was fighting his way Sicily and up into Italy. Uncle Fred, meantime, was in bomb.
So this is Gordy's brother.
Yes, Gordy's brother. Uncle Fred was, I think it was in Skegness, was blown up. He was killed in Skegness defusing a mine.
Oh my God!
So
Jesus.
There you go.
So there was a bit of sacrifice in your family then.
Yeah, but I'm the only one who hasn't sort of served, and without going into detail, it's in the autobiography. But I got involved with sort of certain red, white, and blue organisations. when I was in Scotland, actually had left Belfast to try and keep out of trouble and just jumped into the frying pan in the depths of Galloway. And my two compadres ended up going to jail for 13 years. I kept stum.
Blimey.
And got away with it. But I was investigated several times by Special Branch. Indeed, when I was at the Royal Shakespeare Company in 1983, about 5 years after the boys had gone to jail, I was down rehearsing in London, shouting Read the Will to David Schofield, who was playing Mark Antony, and I was arrested in rehearsals and taken away for questioning, because they always wanted to know why, you know, that I just kept stum, but they followed me around for a few years. But yes, there was a point in time when I wanted to try and become a Royal Marine, but when I looked into it, because I had a bit of a record and people had looked into me, that was going to be a non-starter. So I ended up in drama school, and the rest is history.
My goodness.
That's a route in and a half.
We need to take a quick break right now. We'll see you in a moment.
This episode is brought to you by Etsy. Looking to instantly upgrade your Mother's Day gift from typical to meaningful? Shop Etsy. Now until May 12th, get up to 30% off personalized jewelry, style, decor, and so many other items mom will love. And if you want her to know you put a ton of thought into her present, use Gift Mode. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting, so you can easily find well-crafted, original, and affordable pieces from small shops. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about mom, and Gift Mode instantly gives you curated ideas based on hundreds of personas. Need something original and affordable for Mother's Day? Etsy has it. Shop until May 12th for up to 30% off gifts for mom. Terms apply.
Canva presents stories to keep you up at night. It was an ordinary work day until...
The Singapore presentation is at
3 a.m.
The office was shocked.
That's when we sleep.
Maya made it less scary with Canva.
I'll just record my presentation so Singapore can watch it anytime.
Record and present anytime with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.
Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
Welcome back to We Have Ways of Making You Talk.
Did your mother ever talk about Gordy? I mean, you know, the letters are obviously too painful, so she never opened them. I mean,
yes.
You can imagine what it must be like. I mean, I've got the telegram here where they're, you know, priority CCJS Glenny Esquire 1 Rosori Terrace Enniskillen,
which is still there.
Deeply regret to inform you of report received from Central Mediterranean area that Lieutenant JG Glenny, Royal Irish Fusiliers, was killed in action on 27th October 1943. The Army Council desire to offer you their sincere sympathy. Under Secretary of State for War. I mean, You know, when you get that dreaded telegram that so many people received over the two wars, you're obviously that's devastating. But that just throws up so many. You're just going to want to know all the answers, aren't you? And none of them are there. Was it a mistake? Could there be a mistake here? You know, what happened to him? How was he killed? Did he suffer? All those sort of things. So then, to have the letters from Laurie Frankly Vale explaining what happened must have been a huge help. But then, you know, I mean, I've got you've sent me literally everything, and there's his, you know, his soldier's service book here with a sort of battered kind of paper jacket, and I'm just going to hold this up now, and it's got his kind of, you know, 5'7¼", 34.5-inch chest, eyes blue, weighed 130 pounds, complexion fresh, hair fair, you know, and scribbled over it in red crayon,
deceased.
You know, that gets sent back to the family.
Yeah, Muriel.
It's brutal, yeah, isn't it?
Mum never really got over it, although it has to be said that Frank's letters were a great comfort to her, and the honesty that he dealt with the situation was a comfort to her. So she knew really what had happened, and from their relationship. I mean, there again, when you read those letters, James, you might be forgiven for thinking there might have been more going on with Muriel and Frank. It's just one of those things. There certainly wasn't, but, you know. No, I'm very lucky that Muriel just put them nicely in a box and left them. And of course, you know, I took that box wasn't going anywhere. That came with me after my mother and father had passed away. And indeed, Quentin's stuff, my dad, I've got most of that. But unfortunately, I digress slightly, he lost most of his treasures because, another true story, when the Burmese used to look after the airfield up the Irrawaddy River and patrol it at night, they weren't very good or reliable. And the Pathans were recruited, who, as you know, are from down the road in Afghanistan or whatever. But anyway, I couldn't believe this. He said, oh, yeah, he said, we had a tribe of Pathans, and they came up, and we used to pay them, and we used to give... there was one guy who used to smash up tail lights and say there were semi-precious stones and give those to them, and all sorts of carry-on went on. But at the end of the war, my dad he actually led the squadron, although he was not officially made squadron leader. He was just the senior flyer who was left. So he led the squadron towards the end of the war, last couple of months of the war. Indeed, he has a personal letter from Lord Louis Mountbatten. So he's mentioned in dispatches, but he also has a personal letter from which I have, thanking him for his service and that Lord Louis Mountbatten had heard about his sacrifice and all the rest of it. But anyway, so when it came, so then he spent the next month or so flying serviceable aircraft back to Rangoon, flying back up to various airfields and beating up old things that were just falling apart. They were then destroyed, and he would fly back one that was in good nick from said airfield or whatever. So he did that, and he was paid all sorts of currency. He was given huge numbers of gifts, not just your usual samurai swords, but uniform, all sorts of kit and caboodle that he... threw in several bags, parachute bags. I've got his parachute bag, actually, because he never... I don't know whether this is true or not, he said, but nobody in 79 Squadron ever kept one because you didn't want to fall into the middle of the jungle and get caught by the Japanese because the Thunderbolt men weren't that popular. So anyway, the several parachute bags were stuffed full of booty and money and all sorts of carry-on. And he was met by a warrant officer at the airfield in Rangoon, and his luggage was taken and all his kit and caboodle was taken to be taken to the hotel. And said warrant officer, about 6 months later, was arrested because he'd been stealing. This had been a routine, and he'd been stealing all this stuff from, and not just my dad's stuff. And I remember having the conversation with Q, as he was called, and I said to him, Q, so what happened to the warrant officer? And he said, well, let's leave that up to the imagination, but we never saw him again. So, he was a colourful character, me daddy.
I should say so. It's absolutely amazing. I mean, Al's got good Second World War heritage in his family. Mine is limited to both my grandfathers were auxiliary firemen, one in Birmingham and one in London. But I don't have any relatives that, as far as I'm aware, served overseas or anything.
I'm being well trumped here, to be honest.
This is very impressive. You know, two uncles killed. You know, another one a fighter pilot in a Thunderbolt, in the father a Thunderbolt pilot. I mean, another one on the Atlantic convoys.
Mother never ever talked about what she did, the Americans, apart from the fact that she couldn't discuss it because it was not, I don't know what they had in those days, whether it was the official secrets or whatever, but she was heavily involved with what the Americans and the South Africans and Canadians were getting prepared for on D-Day. And she was the one who never discussed anything about that at all. You know, if you gave Q a cream of the barley and soda, or a few of them, and he would quite happily regale you with stories about the war. He thoroughly enjoyed it. And I remember when they were living in Enniskillen, and there was an old airfield there called St. Angelo Airfield, which was also used as a Catalina base and a Sunderland base. And it was owned by the Duke of Westminster in the sort of 60s and 70s. Anyway, a flying club was formed, and Q was asked, obviously, you know, there weren't many sort of ex-fighter pilots in Enniskillen, and Q was sort of invited to join. And his description of flying, I mean, he just went up and sort of, yeah, right, just give me the controls, you know. And fearlessly sort of scared the crap out of this the person next to him. But he did it twice and then packed up, because he said flying a Cessna around over Enniskillen is not the same as flying a Thunderbolt up the Irrawaddy.
Yeah, I can imagine. I always wonder how those fighter pilots kind of coped with civilian life. And, you know, one minute you're kind of your top dog, you're a young kind of 22-year-old, and you're dashing and you've got good kit and you're kind of flying around in Spitfires or Thunderbolts, yeah, or whatever it might be. And then suddenly it's all over and that's taken away from you and you've just sort of got to get back and get on to life. And I would kind of, you get the impression that a lot of people, life never quite...
No, it didn't match up to that. It
didn't match up.
And no.
I think a lot of people felt that. I mean, a friend of mine's grandfather, he talked about, and he was in 8th Army for the whole of the war. He always said that the war was in colour and the rest of his life was in black and white after that.
Yeah.
That's amazing.
Good description.
He got back from this friend of mine's grandfather. He arrived at Waterloo, and he lived in Mitcham, so he walked back home from Waterloo through South London, all the way down to Mitcham, and went to the pub first, had a couple of pints, and then went to see his wife, who he hadn't seen for 5 years.
That's just amazing.
Q actually took me to, when I lived in the Isle of Dogs, before it became the Île des Chiens, so to speak. I remember Q coming down, bringing some stuff. I just got into drama school, sort of, so he was driving down. We lived in Scotland then, and he drove down with a lot of stuff for me. And I remember him saying, right, we're going for a pint. And I says, Dad, where in the name of God do you know around here? He said, just you come with me. And we ended up in the Waterman's Arms off the highway in East London. And he said, that's where we used to sit there. And he said, the pub hadn't changed, the Waterman's Arms. And I said, Daddy, what? He said, yeah, well, when we got a bit of leave and we were able to go up to London, we never bothered with going to see shows or any of this bloody stuff.
Just sitting the booze
up. We used to go to the Waterman's Arms, and he said, and it's still there. And that's where we had a pint. And I remember him looking around, saying if there were any signatures on the timbers above the bar that he could remember. There weren't, but, you know, he said that was... I mean, they were young men. They did what young men did, you know.
And what about... You know, when you were growing up and you were a kid, I mean, were you aware of your uncles that had been killed in the war? I mean, did you know about them?
Well, Mum always...
Or was it kind of not talked about?
No, I mean, Mum quite often would talk about Gordy, but she never really got over his death. And
really? They were close,
yeah,
were they?
And,
really close.
And, of course, I suppose when your brother goes off to war... he's a hero, and then when he's killed, he's even more of a hero. And she has the letters, and Frank talking about their friendship, Frank and Gordy, or John or Paddy or whatever, you know. It was she never really got over it, although she was deeply proud. As I say, she would talk for a bit, but then she would get upset, and that would be the end of it. Uncle George, I only really spoke to him about it when he was in the Royal Victoria Hospital towards the end of his life. But he seemed quite happy with his service. Dad, of course, as I say, with the cream of the barley and what have you, would quite happily talk about it. And when I was very young, he actually taught me to fire his service automatic, which he took back with him. So somehow got it back into Northern Ireland of all bloody places. But he had it.
That's amazing.
He had it next to the bed, and indeed I have the case at the other end of the room. For the purposes of your podcast, gentlemen, I shall say this only once. The automatic 2.2 pistol disappeared. More I cannot reveal or what have you. But anyway, so at a young age, you say, where did you get that, Daddy? Because we'd only seen them in the movies. And of course, so he was quite happy to talk about all sorts of carry on. And although I think he had a pretty tough war, and I remember, I'll never forget, when he was in a home, bless him, I was away working, he was up in Scotland, and Mum had died years before, and he was on his own, and he made the decision to go into this old folks' home. And we all know the horrendous stories, although I'm not casting aspersions on the home at all. I remember sitting with him one day talking about the war and Thunderbolts, and I remember him talking about things like, you know, when we got four paddles on the Thunderbolt as opposed to three, all this sort of stuff, and fascinating, and the stuff they used to make the aircraft do in action, and, you know, and what a great airplane the Zero was because it was made by Mitsubishi and stuff. And he said, I've always wanted a Mitsubishi pickup and all this sort of And then visiting him about 2 or 3 days later, he was there, a war hero, although he never called himself one, he was to me, sitting in a nappy, on his last leg, so to speak. And he said to me, if I could ask you to smother me, I would, because this is worse than Burma. And you sort of think, my God. And unfortunately, he died a few days later in my wife's arms. But we don't realise, we can't realise because we weren't alive and we didn't go through that. I mean, you even think, I revisited the Battle of Britain the other day, the movie, and I know you've talked about it. And you just, you see the young Ian McShane, who's probably about 30, but he's playing someone who's sort of 19. And I look back to when I was 19, in the name of Jesus, you know what I mean? It is extraordinary, I think we forget, and we need to take time and just occasionally think, say it to young people, do you know what, son? When my daddy was your age, he was flying up the Irrawaddy bloody river in a Thunderbolt, getting shot at from the ground and the air.
Yeah.
You know, we don't know we're born.
Well, how old was Gordy? 21, 22, something like that? Yeah. I mean, he was nothing, was he? Have you ever been out to his grave, or
no,
did your mum ever go?
My mum went, and my gran and Gordy's Gordy's mother went, and mother and father went. But it's on my list now, definitely, and when I was filming or doing something, and I tried to get to the Sangro River Cemetery where he's buried, and I couldn't because of timings. But what a small world. After I'd had a chat with Eddie O'Sullivan on his podcast, blow me, I got a letter from a lady who visited the Sangro River Cemetery on a regular basis to see her relatives, and she always put flowers on Gordy's grave. And I said, what's the connection? One of the relatives that she was visiting served with Gordon. And so, when she went, as often as she could, and she sent me a photograph of Gordy's grave with the flowers that she'd placed on it.
How lovely.
Isn't it? So
amazing.
I find it emotional. Debbie wants to go.
Well, it is emotional.
Debbie's decided we should go, so we are going to go next year and go to the Sangro River Cemetery. Excuse me, what a big wuss.
No, well, it is emotional. It's emotional and it's upsetting and you feel you can't help but feel those thoughts about, you know, what must he have been thinking lying out there on that night attack, knowing that he was slipping away, and you just think about the cruelty of someone in the prime of their life being cut down.
Yeah,
I mean, you know, I've been kind of living with this for the last year of kind of how awful it was in Italy, and you know, it doesn't get any better. I mean, you know, and spoiler alert, you know, poor old Laurie doesn't get through either. You know, he gets cut down in the Battle for Rome in May 1944, and. You know, I remember when I was first reading all those letters, I was just absolutely devastated. I mean, I was devastated when Gordy died, and I was also devastated when Laurie Frankly Vale
I was recording those letters, and you hadn't told me what was coming, Jim.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking, well, this lovely, this friendship's a fantastic thing, you know, and they've found some solace in the squalor of and the dread of fighting, and then he's killed, and it's it found the thing completely knocked me sideways. Yeah.
It's devastating. It's absolutely devastating.
It's absolutely devastating, and to personalise the thing that everyone, you know, my grandmother lost her husband and her brother. Read in, you know, to get inside those feelings through these letters. It's an incredible thing. And I think, I mean, an amazing thing that your family, that you're comfortable with people talking about this in such an open way, Charlie, I think is really amazing. It's really important.
I think it's important, not just for me, but for, you know, younger people to listen, and God willing they do listen to your podcast, because it is utterly brilliant. And if you've any sort of interest in history, you know, your podcast, gentlemen, would make history O level and history A level a lot more interesting. And that's not casting aspersions on the teaching staff, but honest to God, I was lucky enough to to study with gentlemen who had served in the Second World War, and they made history very interesting, and my interest in history and the Second World War in particular grew from there. And living history is reading those letters and feeling the emotions as I do, I'm very, very, very lucky to have them, and I consider myself very, very lucky that my family served. And you know how good it is to have that pride. And no one can ever say a bad word about my family, although, you know, Daddy and I fell out on numerous occasions, as sons and fathers do. You know, I'm immensely proud of their service, and absolutely delighted to be invited on to talk about it, boys, honest to God, because it's not something you sort of bring up in the pub unless someone asks you, you know what I mean?
Well, we're absolutely delighted that you've come on. I just think it's fantastic, and that you've made the connection and you got in touch, and I'm, you know, incredibly grateful to you for sending me all the letters. I mean, what an amazing collection they are. And I think one of the other things about both the letters, I mean, Gordy's letters that he writes home to his mum, you know, in the first part of his army career, they're incredibly vivid, and so are Laurie Franklin Vale's. And I think one of the things about him is, you know, he's not a buttoned up Englishman. He's an Aussie.
He's an Aussie, yeah.
And he's a heart on his sleeve kind of guy, and he just tells you everything. I mean, it's just absolutely, you know, the unvarnished kind of reality, and it just pours out of him. And he was a journalist before the war anyway, so he's got the gift of the pen, and his letters and his descriptions and the importance of his friendship with Gordy are obviously profound and deep for him. And so, you know, when you're reading these letters, you can't help but get incredibly involved in his life and those around him, such as Gordy, and they kind of, you know, they might be long dead, but they're vividly brought back to life in the words that they've left behind. And that's incredibly powerful, because when you're talking to a kind of, you know, an 80 or a 90-year-old, sometimes it can be hard to imagine what they were like as a strapping young 21-year-old, because they're kind of old and decrepit and roomy-eyed and, you know, a shadow of physically of the person that they used to be. And, you know, a lot of years and decades has gone in between. But when you're reading these letters, you're getting the thoughts of a young man on the day that he's writing it. You know, he's sitting there writing this letter in a muddy foxhole, in a dugout, in a tent, in a shattered farmhouse, wherever it might be, and you're just transported back there in an incredibly vivid way. And particularly so with someone like Laurie Frankenfeld, because he, you know, officers self-censor, so they don't really censor anything at all in his case. I mean, you know, he doesn't say specifically where they are, but if you kind of match up the letters to the war diaries, it's very easy to work it out. And suddenly you've got this unbelievable, from the horse's mouth, in the moment, at the time, description of what is going on. And how can anyone fail to not be kind of deeply and profoundly moved by reading about Laurie Frankenfeld's description of your uncle's last moments? It's devastating.
But even when he writes, there's one of the letters, I'm not sure whether I still have it here, but he's in a cave writing, and you know, you're right there, you're just right there in this bloody cave, and it's pissing down the rain outside, and he's writing a letter home.
Well, listen, Charlie, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been utterly fascinating. Really, really brilliant to get you on. And very much looking forward to seeing you at We Have Ways Fest 4.
Yes, that would be fantastic.
Put it in the diary. I will 19th to the 21st of July.
And, you know, anything you'd like me to do, I'd be honoured. But also, it'll be good to have a pint.
Thanks very much, Charlie. Thanks, everyone, for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this. We'll see you all again very, very soon. Bye-bye.
Cheerio.
Bye.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost 3 decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.